This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Eric Asadourian, Senior Fellow at World Watch Institute and Co-Director of State of the World 2012. Eric Asadourian is here today to tell us about the State of the World 2012 report, Moving Toward Sustainable Prosperity, and to discuss the path to degrowth in overdeveloped countries. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Diane.
Would you like to begin by telling us about the World Watch Institute and your yearly State of the World reports?
Sure, I'd be happy to. World Watch is a sustainable development think tank that's been around since 1976 and has been looking at different environmental and social sustainability issues since then. And more, unfortunately, as the situation degrades, as we haven't really moved towards sustainability yet, we continue to draw more and more attention to the issues and offer as much as possible concrete solutions to get us towards a truly sustainable society.
What led World Watch to choose moving towards sustainable prosperity as a topic for the 2012 State of the World report?
That's a good question. Every year we have a conversation about, okay, what should we really theme the issue on? We've been theming the State of the World since 2004, as we feel that that gives us a little bit more ability to draw attention to some key issues every year. And this year, especially with the Rio Plus 20 summit happening, the next Earth summit, and there's basically one every decade. And one of the key themes this year is a green economy as a means to reduce poverty. And green economy, surprisingly, is a very contentious term, especially within the developing country arena. In part, I think, is that the term is not owned by them, in a sense, and they really are steering away from that term. So we, at first, the working title was actually on green economy, but we really wanted to step back and look at, well, what's the point of a green economy? It's sustainable prosperity. That is the end point, is how do we create a prosperous global society that is not undermining Earth's ability to sustain humans, and not just present humans, but future humans, as well as other Earth systems and other species, so that the system can remain robust and healthy in perpetuity.
Before we focus in detail on your chapter on degrowth, would you give a brief overview of the State of the World 2012 report? What are the highlights?
Well, the highlights at the macro level, we're really trying to define what sustainable prosperity is, just as I was starting to do that, and really kind of pointing out that the end goal of sustainable development, which we use so much now as a term and sustainability, is this idea of a functioning and thriving human society that's not undermining Earth systems. Then we go into some real concrete details of what that would look like. So the first few chapters are talking about what a green economy could be, how it could stimulate more jobs as we pursue that, and good livelihoods, but also in ways that don't undermine the Earth and make us prosperous. But then we get into the real weeds in the other chapters. I mean, there are 17 chapters. We go into transportation, food economy, both on the kind of the biggest scale, what does a sustainable food system look like, but also zooming in on meat and livestock, because prosperity often is associated with more meat consumption, and that's really happening in developing countries as well. The idea that I'm not happy unless I'm eating meat once or twice or even three times a day is a cultural norm that has spread worldwide, and it's an impossible one to sustain. There's 60 billion farm animals, as are in the global livestock, and that is causing major climate pollution. Causing nitrogen runoff that's destroying the seas. So it really goes into details on a whole range of issues that are central and essential to address to create a sustainable, prosperous society.
Now let's focus on degrowth. What is your definition of degrowth and why do we need it?
Degrowth, it's an intentionally provocative term that is working at two levels. First of all, specifically, the idea is to intentionally contract overly developed economies and move them back within Earth's limits. But it's also moving away more broadly from the idea of a growth myth, right? Our culture, the United States and Europe and increasingly all cultures around the world, have this strange mythology that growth is good. Not certain types of growth, but just growth. So if the economy grew, that's good, right? And you see that throughout the media. You hear that in policymakers' speeches. Everything is about growth. And unfortunately, growth and our consumer model is really at the root cause of our undermining of Earth's systems. I mean, we need a different model that doesn't necessarily focus on stimulating consumption and growth as a means to improve human well-being, but instead focuses straight on human well-being and improving people's livelihood without actually making growth and stuff and more production and energy usage all at the heart of that process. So that degrowth is trying to grab the bull by the horns, in a sense, and really challenge the idea of a growth economy and talk about what ways could we move beyond this idea of growth and create eventually, I mean, the goal that is talked about by ecological economists is a steady state economy. But we're so far over the limits of the Earth that we actually have to first contract our economic throughput to a point where we could actually achieve a steady state economy.
How much degrowth or reduction in economic output is needed worldwide to protect our ecological capacity?
I'll give you that number, although with a big caveat, which is that there is an extreme disparity in consumption levels worldwide. So one number for that is the ecological footprint indicator, which many will be familiar with, that we use 1.5 Earth's worth of ecological capacity every year. Of course, we only have one Earth, so that means we're undermining the ecological capital that we depend on, which is manifesting in a shifting climate, in deforestation, in pollination declines, in river freshwater and ocean declines. So we're seeing the effects of consuming beyond Earth's systems limits. And so we have to kind of curb down total human consumption, even as the human population grows. It's projected to grow from the 7 billion that we have currently to 9 or 10 billion before stabilizing. So we definitely have to curb down, but we have to also recognize that many countries are consuming under their limits, while many, like the United States, are consuming far beyond their limits.
You're speaking about countries such as the U.S. as being overdeveloped. Would you say more about that and the problems associated with it?
Yeah, again, I have to say that that word was also provocative, like degrowth, because we often talk about underdeveloped countries, countries that are suffering with poverty issues, illiteracy, infant mortality rates, and then we talk about developed countries. And no one ever talks about overdeveloped countries. And what I would say that means is there's a certain set of side effects that come with overdevelopment. The easiest and most obvious is obesity and overweight. Two-thirds of Americans are now overweight or obese, and that is shortening our lifespans, that's causing diabetes, heart disease, cancers, and ill health more broadly. And that's coming from a system that over-focuses on centralized processed food production, subsidizing of sugar and corn, and that ends up leading to the whole set of unhealthy food options, which are being marketed aggressively to the population, encouraging them to eat that. Combine that with the overdevelopment of our car-based transportation system, and most people aren't walking enough so that they're not exercising and they're gaining weight for those reasons. And then, of course, you play that out, and these are all feeding into each other. So you have pharmaceutical dependence at higher levels now, where many Americans are on either anti-cholesterol drug or blood pressure drugs, in part because of diet, in part because of work stress, because we're one of the most overworked countries in the world. I think we're the third bestseller of pharmaceuticals now in the United States are antidepressants. All of these are manifestations of a cultural path that is not in Americans' best interest. But unfortunately, there's over $200 billion a year being spent encouraging us to consume against our interest through marketing, and combine that with development strategies that unfortunately put corporate interest often over community interest. And you have a overdeveloped system that is not actually achieving sustainable prosperity at all, even as it's undermining Earth systems faster than any other country in the world.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Asadourian, Senior Fellow at World Watch Institute and Co-Director of State of the World 2012. Our topic is the State of the World 2012 report, Moving Towards Sustainable Prosperity, and the Path to Degrowth in Overdeveloped Countries. And you are tuned to the Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What is the economic goal under a policy of degrowth?
That's a great question. Going back to the definition, there's the two parts. One is to contract the economy's overall economic throughput, but the second is to just recognize that growth as a driving myth of the economy is not the goal. So at one level, at the meta level, the goal is simply not to talk about growth as the key measure of whether economy is doing well. Are people healthier and happier and more satisfied should be the language of the future of whether economy is thriving, right? So annual checkups on infant mortality rates and literacy rates and high school graduation rates become the measure of a good economic system. Hopefully that evolves over time. But in the short term, it's an intentional process of saying, okay, which economic sectors do we want to thrive and move forward? Is any economic product good, or should we be intentionally recognizing that certain sectors of the economy do not make America better? And if that's the case, how do we intentionally move away from those sectors? So even if it shrinks overall GDP, how do we move away from a car-centric economy? Or how do we move away from a processed food-centric economy that is unfortunately causing obesity? But can we start stimulating more people to grow food in their backyards and provide for themselves, leading to more exercise for them, healthier food, a deeper connection with the earth, and displacing a lot of the toxic food that they're eating now? And the interesting thing is, if you look through our history, there have been times where we've been incredibly successful at doing just that. During World War I and II, we encouraged Americans to grow food in their backyard or in a local community garden, and that provided for 40% of all household vegetable consumption during World War II. And now we have even more lawn space, which unfortunately right now is absorbing huge amounts of pesticides and artificial fertilizers and other toxic chemicals. And imagine making all those lawns into small home gardens that is providing healthy food and exercise and all of that. From a pure economic product measure, that's probably not a good thing, but it would be a significant boon to American society. So there's those processes of basically inverting, in many cases, what economic progress even looks like.
Would you speak now about the most significant barriers to bringing about degrowth?
They are many. As I kind of pointed out, there is a whole mythology around growth is good, and so to take it head on will probably not succeed in the immediate future. But at the same time, there are many ways to challenge subcomponents of a growth economy. So, for example, the recession is not degrowth, of course. One great degrowth philosopher talks about there's a stark difference between recession and degrowth, and it's kind of the equivalent of looking at someone who is intentionally dieting degrowth because of weight issues versus someone who's starving, which is a recession. It causes much disruption. But at the same time, effectively using a recession to, instead of just re-jumpstart the growth process, instead consolidating and using that recession to help in the degrowth process. So one example is, during this past recession in the U.S., multi-generational households shot up about 10%. Because suddenly elder parents couldn't afford their homes, so they moved in with their younger children, or recent college graduates moved in with their parents, which just seems bad from our individualist culture that celebrates independence and including economic independence. But throughout our history, and not in Americans, but as humans, we've often lived in multi-generational housing, and there's real opportunities and benefits socially, as well as sharing labor. In fact, one study showed that those multi-generational houses during the recession even as they had less income, were less affected by poverty. And that's because they were sharing workloads. They were sharing space. There was more opportunity to have an elder parent who might have been in a nursing home or been living alone was suddenly a primary caregiver of a younger child. And that younger child, at the same time, was helping that elder individual to stay engaged, energized, and so they were probably going to delay late-life problems like dementia and those kind of effects. So by having a multi-generational housing, even that small change can have significant impacts on lowering ecological effects. I mean, if you have one larger multi-generational home instead of lots of small unit homes, that can be lower impact. It can build social connections. It can reduce economic costs per household. So there's lots of ways to facilitate degrowth with never even talking about degrowth. And that's, I think, one of the key strategies.
To what extent is income inequality a barrier to degrowth?
That's an excellent question. It's a huge barrier. In fact, I think while it's not a popular point in the U.S., I would say, there needs to be a significant increase in taxation on the largest income earners. And in fact, the good news is that we have done that in the past, where we actually had a marginal income tax of 94% on those earning over $200,000 back during World War II. And even for a few decades beyond that, we had an 80% or even a 70% rate of taxation on the largest income earners. And we should really consider doing that again. It's shocking that our rates are so low for the highest income earners, because that money is not only stimulating unuseful consumption, luxury consumption, that money could also be used much more strategically in many different ways. One, facilitating the transition to a sustainable and prosperous economy, meaning creating more bus lanes and metro systems and train systems, facilitating renewable energy and the shift away from fossil fuels, but also even just simply creating a rainy day fund, in a sense, for the natural disasters that will come in the future. Unfortunately, climate change is already built into our future. Even if we are able to prevent the 4-degree scariest scenarios, it's going to be impossible to stop a 2-degree scenario at this point because of the lag time in when emissions affect the climate. So we're pretty much locked into a 2-degree future. So in that future, even the better case scenario, we're going to have more natural disasters, more droughts, more floods. And in fact, last year we had in the U.S. 12 over $1 billion natural disasters that cost society over $1 billion. And we have enough resilience right now in our economy to pay for that. But if we continue to not invest and kind of create a rainy day fund for this, we could find ourselves not being able to rebuild. So using these tax revenues both helps to extract money that is only going to consumption that is just exacerbating problems, to helping to make our society both more resilient and more sustainable.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Ossadorian, Senior Fellow at World Watch Institute and Co-Director of State of the World 2012. Our topic is the State of the World 2012 Report, Moving Towards Sustainable Prosperity and the Path to Degrowth in Overdeveloped Countries. Well, you've been alluding to this, but would you just list the best approaches to degrowth in overdeveloped countries?
Yeah, well, I think you've asked about a few. I think basically there's redistributing tax burden, so not just on higher income, but also on social ills, right? So why isn't advertising taxed? Right now it's actually tax deductible. Pollution could be more taxed. There's many things that could be better taxed that could help facilitate generating revenue to help facilitate the process to a sustainable prosperity. The shifting to a plenitude economy, to use Juliet Shore's words, which is trying to help facilitate local community-based economic product, whether we're talking about local farms or multi-generational households that start internalizing some of the formal economy. The third one I haven't talked about yet is the idea of the work week and working hours. Right now, after labor reforms of the 1800s, the 40-hour work week is the norm. It used to be the 60-hour work week, but it is still just a cultural norm. There's nothing other than convention that makes a 40-hour work week normal. So the ideal is to help make it a 20-hour work week norm so that the average person is working fewer hours. And when you do that, suddenly unemployment disappears or it shrinks significantly, right? If you're redistributing job hours so that people are working less and more people have economic opportunities, of course, you don't keep the same income, unfortunately, for some. But what you would be doing is better distributing that income through working hours, and people would also have much more time to incorporate informal strategies of livelihood, right? So you might have more time to farm your backyard if you have fewer hours to work, or you might not need daycare or childcare if you're working less. And so it's not as strict as just simply going to a 20-hour work week for everybody, but recognizing that there are ways to shorten the lifetime work cycle. And in fact, countries like Sweden, for example, already do that very effectively, where they have 480 days of maternal and paternal leave when you have a new child. So as a couple, you're working many less hours over the lifespan as you have a child. The Netherlands simply created a law that protects the choice to work a 30-hour work week. If I want to work a 30-hour work week in the U.S., very few employers will give me the full benefits that I would like or need, especially with no public health insurance in this country. But the Netherlands actually created a law that said employers can't discriminate against those who choose to work fewer hours. So having those tools to actually facilitate shorter work weeks will help better distribute job hours and help to facilitate that path to degrowth.
Do you see any evidence of a favorable shift to more sustainable consumption patterns in the U.S.?
I'd like to say yes, but it's hard. There are, on the margins, efforts to do that. But it's very hard when the majority of efforts, marketing and others, are trying to stimulate more and more consumption. I think maybe one great example of something that gives me a little hope is that fewer teenagers are actually starting to seek out driver's license. They just value the car less. And so that's helping to shrink both car rates and driving, but also to break through that myth of freedom equals car ownership, which I think is a deep-rooted American myth at this point. And we need to move beyond that myth and recognize that freedom is the ability to walk or take a metro or go wherever you want to go, but in a way that doesn't cost you $7,000 a year in maintaining a car and all that ecological damage that car ownership sustains as well. So that's one good example of one little cultural shift that is happening.
Are companies doing anything in regard to degrowth?
There are a few. At the subtle levels, there's some efforts to edit consumers' choices. So when you walk into a store, you might see the fluorescent lights first rather than the incandescents, and trying to facilitate the consumer to make the right choice. That, of course, is in a context where most stores do the opposite, trying to encourage you to buy the unhealthier product or the more profitable product. Other companies like Patagonia actually are, they did a little marketing campaign recently to encourage people not to buy their product, which was a very bold marketing campaign, discouraging them to buy a product if they don't need it. And then followed up saying, and if you do need it, buy it used, if you really have to get something. And they actually even worked with eBay to facilitate buying their products used, which I think is a great sign. Instead of just simply encouraging people to buy more stuff that they might not need, they noted very clearly that we recognize that our company depends on a stable and sustainable Earth system. And so we want to be in business long into the future. So we don't want you to buy our stuff unless you really need to. And that's a pretty bold statement that I haven't seen replicated elsewhere by many other companies. So there are a few bold corporate leaders.
What kind of response are you getting in the U.S. and also in Europe to your degrowth ideas?
That is a good question. So I'm not the one who coined the term degrowth. I wish I had. But in Europe, it's actually a quite common conversation at this point. There are even political parties focused on degrowth. There are magazines and journals. There's regular conferences. So it's at least not as fringe as it is in the United States. In the U.S., many fewer people are talking in those terms, in part, I think, because the mythology of growth is so much stronger here. But there is this May a degrowth in the Americas conference in Montreal, and there is some movement starting here. I've noticed that it's polarized audiences more in this country, not surprisingly, with some dismissing it outright and others kind of accepting that it's valuable and necessary. In Europe, I think it's a little bit more accepted. Still not in the mainstream, of course, but it's more accepted there.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I would like them to recognize that for true sustainable prosperity, not just in this country, but worldwide, and we as Americans depend on a stable Earth system, not just an American system, we're going to have to start thinking a little bit more long-term, not just about more consumption and more short-term economic growth, but really recognizing that a truly sustainably prosperous society would need to degrow for a while until we get to a stable place where human well-being is really at the heart rather than stimulation of profit, even when it's causing the illness of both humans and the planet.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Eric.
Well, thank you, Diane, for having me.
You have just been listening to Eric Ossadorian, Senior Fellow at World Watch Institute and Co-Director of State of the World 2012. For more information, check on the web at www.worldwatch.org. Again, that's worldwatch.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM. And KEXP.org.